Welcome to the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is the only think tank in Washington, D.C. dedicated exclusively to Taiwan policy research. Our goal is to raise the visibility of Taiwan in the broader policy discussions here in Washington, D.C. and enhance U.S.-Taiwan relations. We undertake three separate programs, a weekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief that provides timely analysis about Taiwan's policy-relevant issues, this bi-weekly seminar series, and also an annual symposium. It's my honor to welcome you to our public seminar on Taiwan defense trends. Before we start the program, I'd like to acknowledge a few of our distinguished attendees here today. We have several of our advisors, Dr. Tsai and Dr. Chen, over here. Welcome. And we also have my friend, U.S. Navy Admiral Diane Weber here. And she's currently the Chief Information Officer at National Defense University and previously Commander of U.S. Navy Cyber Forces. She's humble, never told me these things. I had to look it up on her DoD online official biography. I should also acknowledge our GTI staff with our Executive Director, Russell Shao, and our colleagues, Melissa Newcomb, Anna Scott Bell, Lily Lin, and interns David Lauren and Chen Yen helping today. So today is a timely moment to discuss Taiwan defense trends. Taiwan just recently released its new 2017 Quadrennial Defense Review, which is only Taiwan's third ever QDR, with the first in 2009, second in 2013, and now. I've seen the Chinese version because it's already available online, but the English version has not yet been released. So we're gaining a lot of new insight between the QDR itself, the session in Taiwan's Legislative Yuan with Defense Minister Feng on March 16th, we're hearing that Taiwan will raise military spending from 2% to 3% of GDP. Also, that Taiwan wants to acquire or develop fifth-generation fighter aircraft like F-35 with vertical takeoff and landing, indigenous attack submarines, improve air defense systems with mobile launchers, upgrade surface naval combatants, deploy smart sea mines, create a fleet of UAVs, and establish a new cyber warfare unit. There are also rumors of an upcoming U.S. arms sale to Taiwan by the Trump administration. Before I turn to the panel, I want to first dispel three myths about U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. Myths like U.S. arms sales are an insurance policy. That myths like Taiwan pays more than others for the same systems. Myths like the U.S. sells old junk equipment to Taiwan. I think these originate as fake news or alternative facts from late-night news commentary shows where the commentator sees something happening in the world, like an arms sale, and wildly guesses and offers creative ideas to explain it. The audience loves it, it's useful in domestic politics against the incumbent, and the news keeps repeating it for years until everybody thinks it's true. These especially bother me because of my over 5 years of experience on the U.S. side working on Taiwan arms sales. At the U.S. State Department, Office of Regional Security and Arms Transfers, show me these myths are untrue. First, no, Taiwan arms sales are not an insurance policy that guarantees that the U.S. will be there in a conflict. No, the lives and deaths of U.S. soldiers cannot be bought with money. There are far different geopolitical calculations and discussions about U.S. national interest at work. Number two, no, Taiwan does not unfairly pay more for the same weapon systems than other countries. Taiwan uses the same DoD foreign military sales channels and State Department direct commercial sales channels as every other country. Costs can change year by year, but that depends on the economy of scale. The same missile has a cheaper per unit cost 1 year when 10 countries happen to buy 1,000 units combined, then another year where it's more expensive when only two countries buy 200. Costs do not depend on whether or not you have other options or not. Three, no, the U.S. does not take advantage of Taiwan by selling Taiwan old, run-down equipment. Yes, the U.S. does transfer used equipment, but this is through a special program called Excess Defense Articles, EDA program. Everything else that the U.S. sells to Taiwan is new. For EDA, the price is the key because we're talking about transferring used equipment at a fraction of the original cost, usually around 5% or higher, a little higher, depending on the age and condition of the equipment. So the U.S. government tries to make hot transfers, meaning that the equipment works well and is not mothballed. With naval vessels, the goal is for the U.S. sailors to walk off and Taiwan sailors to walk on. It's in that good of a running condition. So the analogy I use is if I like your Honda Accord, and you're willing to sell it to me used, okay? You bought it for $20,000 4 years ago. It's now worth $8,000 on Kelley Blue Book. But you sell it to me at 5% of the original purchase price, which is $1,000. So $1,000 for a four-year-old Honda Accord, clean and in good condition. So who is taking, who is doing whom a favor here? So now, looking back on QDR and ARM sales, that is all happening in the context, in the backdrop, of growing cross-strait military imbalance, omnipresent PRC missiles aimed at Taiwan, heightened tensions in the South China Sea, where Taiwan has Ituaba as a claim, and other maritime territorial disputes in Northeast Asia. And if things couldn't get more heated than that, we have North Korea increasingly testing higher yields of nuclear bombs, along with long-range delivery vehicles, as we call it in the profession, but most people know as missiles. And these new developments call for new ideas in Taiwan defense trends. To introduce the panelists, to our immediate left, I have Michael Mazza. He's a research fellow in foreign and defense policy studies at American Enterprise Institute, AEI, where he analyzes U.S. defense policy in the Asia-Pacific region. He also analyzes Chinese military modernization, cross-Taiwan Strait relations, and Korean Peninsula security. Mike has contributed to numerous AEI studies on American grand strategy in Asia, U.S. defense strategy in the Asia-Pacific, and Taiwanese defense strategy, and his published work includes pieces in the Wall Street Journal, Asia, Los Angeles Times, and the National Interest. Ian Easton is a research fellow at the Project 2049 Institute, where he conducts research on defense and security issues in Asia. He worked as a China analyst at the Center for Naval Analyses and has been a visiting fellow at the Japan Institute for International Affairs, JIAA. Eric Gomez is a policy analyst for defense and foreign policy at the Cato Institute. His research focuses on regional security issues, military strategy, and nuclear and conventional deterrence. Amy Chang is an affiliate with the Belfer Center's cybersecurity project at Harvard Kennedy School. Her current research examines cybersecurity and technology policy issues, U.S.-China relations, U.S. foreign and national security policy, and international relations in Asia. Amy was formerly staff director of the Asia and Pacific Subcommittee at the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Foreign Affairs, HVAC, where she was responsible for federal oversight and legislation on political, security, and economic issues in the greater Indo-Asia-Pacific region. So I'll now turn to panelists to give 8 minutes remarks each. And then afterward, I'll share some of my questions and open up to the audience as well. So thank you again for coming today. First, we have Mr. Mike Mazza.
Thank you, David, for the kind introduction, and thanks for having me here at the Global Taiwan Institute today. I've been asked to speak about the cross-strait balance. This is going to be a little bit more backwards-looking than forwards-looking. And I'm going to paint a somewhat bleak picture. For that, I apologize. I know Ian can tell you things aren't quite as bad as I'm going to make them out to be. I don't want to put him on the spot, but he can offer some reassurance if you don't like what I have to say. So I'm going to start by just sort of painting a little bit of a picture of what we've seen happen over the last year or so. In December of last year, China's sole aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, sailed out eastward through the Miaoku Strait, sailed east of Taiwan and down into the South China Sea. And while Chinese J-15 fighters were conducting flight operations off the deck, the United States sustained a global week-long carrier gap. After completing exercises in the South China Sea, the Liaoning sailed through the Taiwan Strait northward home. This marked a much slower, but not necessarily less provocative circumnavigation of Taiwan than those that were conducted by Chinese bombers and fighters in December and November of last year. Working our way backwards further into 2016, Chinese and Russian forces conducted joint drills in the South China Sea in November. September. And Chinese media, according to Chinese media, Chinese Marines there conducted sea crossing, island landing, and island defense and offense operations. In August of last year, the Chinese brought together some 300 vessels in the East China Sea from all three of their fleets in order to practice for what they called a sudden, cruel, and short war in the East China Sea. And these exercises, of course, occurred as China continued to put a focus on improving its forces' abilities to operate jointly. These exercises occurred as China continued to enhance its ballistic and cruise missile capabilities, its aircraft fighter fleet, its naval fleet, enhancing its air defenses, and continued to invest in its amphibious and airborne assault units. Of course, that last one, I think, is a particular concern for Taiwan. DOD reported last year that China continues to improve its ability to conduct and sustain amphibious operations through fleet modernization and joint exercise programs, and noted that in the previous year, 2015, there was an increase in the complexity of an amphibious training. It's been about 4 years now since Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense warned that China, and this is a quote, plans to build comprehensive capabilities for using military force against Taiwan by 2020. And 2020 is sneaking up on us, isn't it? In its national defense report that year, in 2013, which I think was an important report, it marked a shift in public tone in the way that MND talked about the Chinese challenge. In that report, MND reported that the PLA's ISR were sufficient to support the use of military force for resolving the Taiwan issue. They reported that the ground force could already land on and seize an offshore island. They reported that the Air Force could fight for air superiority over the first island chain, which runs from Japan south through Taiwan into the Philippines. If they're right, that's quite a substantial shift in the balance of power. And they wrote that they reported that the Navy, the Chinese Navy, could sustain a blockade of the Taiwan Strait. This all, again, was happening as China was increasing the size and the capabilities of its missile forces, including the fielding of an anti-ship ballistic missile. Altogether, that MND report asserted that, combined with the Navy and Air Force, the PLA is now capable of conducting large-scale joint firepower strikes and denying foreign forces from intervening in disputes across the Taiwan Strait. These advances, which have only continued over the past few years, I think mark a major shift in the balance of power in the Taiwan Strait. Not all that long ago, the balance, I think, somewhat clearly favored Taiwan. Indeed, back in 2000, which I guess actually is sort of a long time ago, back in 2000, Michael O'Hanlon could credibly argue that China cannot invade Taiwan, even under its most favorable assumptions for how such an operation would go. He argued that even coercive operations, short of an all-out invasion, would be quite difficult for the PLA to pull off. Today, invasion certainly remains a tall order, but China is likely capable of employing a variety of other coercive options, and perhaps can already prevent outside powers from intervening in a timely way. Now, while Taiwan was never going to match China tank for tank or fighter for fighter, it certainly bears some responsibility for this shift in the cross-strait balance. I don't want to belabor this point, as it's one we're all familiar with, I think, but Taiwan has simply not evinced, in my opinion, a strong commitment to its defense budget in the years since the transition to democracy in the 90s. Today, Taiwan only commits 2% of its GDP to defense, well, short of the 3% goal that Taiwan's three most recent presidents, including Tsai Ing-wen, have adopted. Of course, there is the commitment to increase that percentage. We'll see. That's down from 4.1% of GDP in 1996. The military budget share of the overall government budget has similarly dropped over the last 20 years. It fell from 22.8% in 1996 to 16% in 2013. And the United States bears some responsibility here, too. Even if Taiwan had been approving larger budgets in recent years, it's not clear that would have led to more investment in some of the capabilities that Taiwan says it needs most. To put it simply, in my opinion, the United States has not been a particularly reliable arms supplier in recent years. Concerns for U.S.-China relations have become, unfortunately, in my opinion, too great a factor in how the United States makes decisions about arms sales to Taiwan. And I think, for example, we can look no further than Washington's handling of the request for new F-16 CDs. You know, reasonable people can disagree on whether or not CDs were the right choice for Taiwan, but I don't think that can explain Washington's years-long simply ignoring of the request. The letter of request sat in an inbox for years. I think political considerations can explain that delay. Finally, it's worth noting that the cross-strait balance is not settled in the Taiwan Strait alone. Defense cuts during the Obama administration have led to a readiness crisis in the U.S. military, something that all the service chiefs have testified on. This means that fewer units are prepared for high-end combat, which weakens conventional deterrence and thus undermines cross-strait balance. China's island-building campaign in the South China Sea, meanwhile, brings Beijing closer to achieving its objective of exerting control in those waters, which would have negative consequences for Taiwan's security. And Chinese actions in the East China Sea, where Beijing is contesting Japanese control of the Senkaku or Diaoyutai Islands, threatens Taiwan as well. Chinese military and paramilitary vessels are gaining extensive experience operating in contested waters northeast of Taiwan. And Chinese sailors are gaining experience operating in close proximity to potential enemy vessels and tracking and evading foreign ships. In the event of a conflict in the Taiwan Strait, the PLA will gainfully employ lessons learned elsewhere, potentially to Taiwan's detriment. Over the longer term, if China were to succeed in establishing control over the Senkaku Islands, and if China were likewise to succeed in extending its hold over the South China Sea, the security implications for Taiwan could be substantial. Not only would Taiwan see its own claims to disputed territories impinged upon, but it would find that its northern and southern flanks had essentially been turned. I think a favorable cross-strait balance requires that China fail in these efforts. And that begs the question, is a favorable cross-strait balance still a realistic goal for the United States and for Taiwan? And I think the short answer is yes. Should Taiwan and the United States invest effectively in their own self-defense capabilities, and should they deepen investment in the bilateral relationship, I think that they can ensure effective deterrence going forward. Absent such investment, the balance in the strait will continue to shift in China's favor, with potentially dangerous effects for cross-strait stability.
Thank you very much, Mike. And then next we have Mr. Ian Easton from Project 2049.
Well, good afternoon to you all, and thank you to David Ahn and to Russell Shell and the entire team here at GTI for the kind invitation to join this panel discussion. I've been asked to make a few remarks about personnel issues, and particularly the status of recruitment, retention, and training in Taiwan. This is, of course, a very important issue right now because Taiwan is at the tail end of a long transition from a conscript-heavy force to an all-volunteer military. And this is a very important transition and an important development, specifically, I think, because of what Michael raised, the point about balance. And how do you measure balance? What are the metrics that you use? Of course, if you use as your metric defense spending and GDP and size of military, there's no way that Taiwan, a country of 23 million people, could compete with the world's second largest economy, a country of 1.3, soon to be 1.4 billion people. And it's unreasonable to expect that Taiwan could do that. Taiwan could spend not just 3% of its GDP, it could spend 100% of its GDP on defense and still not keep up with the PRC. The PRC can, and it will, if given the opportunity, will spend Taiwan to the ground. And that's why it's important that when we think about how we can keep a balance, because I completely agree with Michael that while the balance may be in flux, it may be going in a direction that we don't like, it can be corrected. That there's a lot that has happened, there's a lot of mistakes that have been made, some in Taipei, certainly, some here in Washington, perhaps many here in Washington over the past two administrations on this particular issue. These are all things that can be corrected. But we need to know how to correct it, and we need to know how to measure it if we're going to create a more favorable balance. And so I would argue that when we think about the balance of power, we don't just look at the things that can be easily counted, the budgets, the number of fighter aircraft, the population size. That is the tendency. If you look at the DoD report year after year after year, there's a very natural focus on these issues because this is this is the essence of how we measure military balance, because it's easy. You can quantify it. What we can't quantify, though, that matters far more is quality. It's people. At the end of the day, wars are either prevented or they're not because of people. Wars are either won, if they're fought at all, or they're lost because of people. And so that's why I think it's so important that Taiwan is moving towards, and it's almost there now, an all-volunteer military force. Because by its very nature, a military unit that is 100% staff or personnel who have all volunteered to be there, that unit is an elite unit. It's an elite unit by its very nature. PLA doesn't have units like this. In fact, China doesn't have a normal professional military at all. The Chinese military, the PLA, is the armed wing of the Chinese Communist Party. It relies heavily on conscripts, and its officer corps is manned 100% by members of the Chinese Communist Party. And all the major decisions are made not by the operators, to the extent that they're true operators, I think is debatable, because again, they're members of the Chinese Communist Party, but they're made by political officers with a very different political calculation to the way they do business. So let me just give you one example based on my research in this area, and then I'll tell you a little bit about some anecdotal experiential evidence as well, why I think Taiwan has such a great advantage in terms of quality of personnel, and why I think Taiwan is now taking it to the next level in a way that the PLA cannot compete. If you look at PLA writings on island invasion scenarios, specifically how they would invade Taiwan, they've written about this extensively for well over a decade. There are extensive internal PLA writings. There are operation field manuals, there are textbooks at their command academies, there are a whole range of strategic, doctrinal, operational, and tactical writings on this subject. The lessons that they draw from history are interesting. They look at D-Day as an example to follow, Operation Overlord, the invasion of Normandy, 1944. They sometimes look at the North Africa landings, 1942, as an example to follow. They sometimes look at Sicily, 1943, as an example to follow. And to the extent that they think about the use of helicopters and more recent technologies, they look at the Falkland Islands, and they try to take lessons from that, and they look at Grenada. They will never, ever, ever talk about what happened to the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army in the Pacific in World War II. Because each of those landings, Tarawa, Saipan, Tinian, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, the list goes on and on. Each of those was an extremely difficult and bloody fight. Each of those presented the United States with situations that were not expected. These were not smooth operations. Of course, we emerged victorious in the end, but in some cases, terrible, at a terrible price. They won't look at the failed landings at Dieppe in France in 1942. Never. You'll never see the PLA talk about that. They won't look at the Anzio landings, the failed Anzio landings in south of Rome in 43. Because these are all out of bounds for the PLA. It's politically incorrect, even in internal PLA writings, to address these types of military failures or costly military battles. Because according to the PLA's propaganda, the invasion of Taiwan must be smooth and must go easy. And so, of course, that greatly limits the intellectual development of the officer corps in the PLA, is because they learn nothing from past failure. Failure, of course, is the greatest source of experience and knowledge that any of us will get. We always learn more from the games that we lose than from the games that we win. If you look at the studies that MND does, each of the services and each of the branches has their own professional military journals in Taiwan. And they're very detailed, and they're very professional, and they're very good. And they study history to the full. There is no topic that is off limits to the officer corps in the Taiwan military. And so just based on the written record and analytical work that comes out, I would argue that Taiwan has a real advantage in this area intellectually, in terms of the hearts and minds of the soldiers. In terms of my own limited experience meeting PLA officers, especially high-ranking officers in the PLA from a past job that I had, and then meeting Taiwanese military officers and non-commissioned officers as well, what I've noticed is that there is a significant difference there as well in terms of professionalism. The Chinese military officers tend to act very bureaucratic, and they tend to act in a just an unprofessional manner. They don't go to the gym. These are not guys that are tough operators. They're heavy smokers. I mean, these guys, just you can't imagine seeing them in a bunker in the middle of a war having to stay up for 48 hours straight and not having a heart attack and dying by day two. It's just remarkable when you meet these guys, the actual operators of the PLA, and then you go to Taiwan and you meet these guys, and it's a very different story. And so while there are quantitative reasons to worry about Taiwan's situation, there are qualitative reasons, I think, for hope. In terms of what the United States could do to further improve Taiwan's quality, the quality of the men and women of the ROC armed forces, there's a lot that can be done. First of all, morale is a constant challenge. In a military that is defending a country that is not recognized as a country, morale is always going to be a significant challenge. And that's why I think it's so important, not only for all the very good reasons Michael talked about, but also for the personnel and their confidence, that we start to have regular high-quality arms sales to Taiwan. Because having very good equipment and having it in a regular and reliable fashion is very important for morale and for self-confidence. Having, in the future, hopefully with this administration, having general officers and admirals visit Taiwan would be a very significant signal, I think, for the United States, and that would translate down to recruitment and to retention and helping the Taiwanese armed forces solve some of the problems that they face. Having the opportunity for Taiwan to participate at the Rim of the Pacific Maritime Exercise in Hawaii, RIMPAC, having Taiwan get invited to Red Flag Air Force exercises in Nevada, having the Taiwanese Army invited to Fort Irwin National Training Center in California, 29 Palms of Marine Corps urban warfare training environment there. These are all the types of opportunities that Taiwan has not had that it could benefit from significantly, not only for the tactical lessons, not only for building the latent interoperability between our two militaries that is so important as China continues to advance its military modernization program, but also to give the Taiwanese military that sense of dignity, that sense of self-pride and self-worth that can only come from interactions of this type with the U.S. military. And so while there are certainly challenges that Taiwan faces in a lot of these areas, both hardware and in some cases software challenges, there is a lot that can be done on the U.S. side. And I think in the years ahead, I'm optimistic that this administration will start to at least strongly consider, if not just go ahead and execute, some of these type of programs that are so important for the future of Taiwan or for the future of our own interests, our American interests in peace and stability in the Western Pacific.
Thank you very much.
Now we have Mr. Eric Gomez from Cato Institute.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Sorry if I cough a bit and stuff. Got a bit of a cold going on. So in my talk, I will be grading some of the capabilities that are talked about in Taiwan's new QDR against what I see as the best possible self-defense strategy for the island. I should say I haven't actually seen the complete text of the Chinese QDR yet, so this is mostly based off of media reports. So I'll just leave that caveat out there. So I think that the key to deterrence for Taiwan is denying China a fait accompli and making them fight the war they don't want to fight. So this is the Chinese military, based off of their technology and their doctrine, like Ian said, or emphasizing this, or no, it might have been Michael, the short, brutal island landing campaign. Taiwan needs to develop the sort of capabilities that allow it to make such a campaign essentially impossible for China to pull off. And I think this requires a high-low mix of capabilities. On the high end, you have relatively high-tech and high-quality asymmetric systems designed for air defense, coastal defense, essentially A2AD with Taiwanese characteristics. This is a deterrence by denial strategy, prevent them from achieving their war aims quickly and easily, keep Chinese forces off the beach as long as you possibly can. On the low end, this is emphasizing quantity over quality. This is, a lot of it has to do with reserve forces and how they're managed and equipped. And this is deterrence by punishment. This is, if the front line can't hold, then make advancement and Chinese attempts to take and hold territory prohibitively costly, using things like portable anti-tank guided weapons, mines, drones, small arms, etc. So, keeping this in mind, how does the 2017 QDR stack up? I think there are a number, I think on the whole it's a positive development, with some mixed things in there. So I'll go from positive to negative. Increasing defense spending as a percent of GDP up to 3%, I think that's a very positive development. I know that we can't always trust the bean counting to represent an accurate picture, but more money is always good when you're talking about Taiwan's ability to defend itself. My concern with this, though, is that it seems to be reported as in response to what's happening in the United States, with Donald Trump being less of a sort of predictable president and not sure what his level of commitment to allies will be. I hope that this increase in defense spending outlasts the Tsai administration and continues on in whatever administration comes next. I hope it becomes a regular feature that is not solely based off of, or not heavily influenced by, what's happening in the United States. An increased attention to the development of indigenous weapon systems is also a big positive. It's a smart idea to hedge against a possible reduction in U.S. commitment or a military situation where the United States cannot easily come to Taiwan's defense and Taiwan might have to stick it out for itself for a while. I don't think, realistically speaking, I don't think that's going to happen, even under the Trump administration or in U.S. policy in general, because Congress is so supportive of Taiwan in general. But it's good to hedge against that for a number of reasons. Cyber capabilities are also a really big positive. Leveraging these new emerging technologies is not only important for Taiwan's defense situation, but if you can somehow have spillover effects from cybersecurity on the military and into the economy in general, to help protect IP, to help fight Chinese commercial or military espionage, that also has positive effects for Taiwan in general beyond just the defense issue. Getting into some of the mixed things, submarine program, I think, is mixed. On the plus side, it boosts the experience of Taiwan's defense industry in developing complex systems, and it can be absolutely be used for A2AD against China. Submarines are a great capability for that. However, my concern are high costs, relatively long time horizons, and while it does exploit Chinese weaknesses in anti-submarine warfare, if the Chinese are able to correct some of those weaknesses over the time it takes for the new submarines to be fielded, then the sort of asymmetric advantage of the submarines might be reduced. Some alternatives to be considered for this type of mission could be greater incorporation of unmanned systems, mini-submarines. I know they have a very negative political connotation because the DPRK in Iran uses them. But there's a really great CSBA report from, I think, 3 years back that made that sort of recommendation, right? This sort of, it still gets you a measure of A2AD capability while being slightly easier to produce, and you can have more for the same amount of money. On the purchasing of fifth generation fighter, potentially with vertical or short takeoff and landing capability, The pros are that this expands the target set for the PLA if they have to not just target airfields, but also target potential roadways or other staging areas where these aircraft could take off from. That's good. So it enhances ROCAF survivability on the ground. However, they're still outgunned, right? It just in terms of the amount of quality or quantity, and increasingly the better quality forces that China could bring to bear, just from a capabilities perspective, not necessarily from a pilot perspective. To the conflict, you need quite a few planes to make a significant dent, I think, in the cross-strait military balance. There's been some talk about an offensive conventional strike via ground launch cruise missiles. I view this as more of an outright negative for Taiwan. It does bring some operational benefits in terms of being able to strike Chinese facilities. However, traditionally, historically speaking, there's been escalation risks associated with having such a system. And it also presents a targeting challenge of if you have to try and shut down all the Chinese bases that could be used against Taiwan, then you're going to have thousands of these things on hand. And I just think that the money could be better spent elsewhere. So overall, I think Taiwan's QDR has some problems, but in many ways, it's a large step forward. The big positives here are using new technologies, especially cyber and unmanned systems, boosting the domestic defense industry, and increasing defense spending. The problems mostly revolve around cost of certain systems and the long time horizons associated with either developing them or trying to negotiate a purchase of them. I think if we're looking at that quantity versus quality mix, Taiwan is still very much focused on the high-end fight. They want to have, in terms of their layered deterrence approach, they want to have that first layer be really, really hard to get through. But I worry about what happens if that layer gets through, if that layer gets broken through. However, even the problematic things in the current QDR are steps in the right direction. The QDR definitely exploits Chinese operational weaknesses and things like anti-submarine warfare, and trying to target fixed infrastructure with SLBMs. And it's correcting deficiency in indigenously produced forces. So it's the right mindset, but I think more attention needs to be paid to opportunity costs in terms of what do you spend on? Do you want that? If you want to keep emphasizing the high quality, or do you want to maybe switch up some of the purchasing decisions and go for maybe more numerous systems? A RAND report on air defense options for Taiwan that came out sometime within the last year is a really good example of laying out certain options that Taiwan could have for air defense systems and showing that you can have certain advantages by having a surface-to-air missile-heavy force rather than a fighter-heavy force, for example. On sort of other things than China, South China Sea and DPRK, I think China should still be the primary focus, and Taiwan should do what it will on the South China Sea on that front. On the DPRK, the thing I would look out for is escalation concerns between U.S. and China in a Taiwanese conflict that are sort of enhanced by things that the U.S. does to respond to the DPRK. So, for example, Chinese concerns about missile defense proliferation in East Asia. What sort of policy decisions does that lead for Chinese nuclear forces? I'm very worried, and I think there's a good chance that instead of just building out their nuclear forces and keeping no first use very strict, that they will play a bit loose with no first use, but keep their forces relatively small, which doesn't necessarily get rid of the escalation concerns or escalation pressures that exist. So I think my time's up, so I'll leave it there, but if you want to talk more about that, the nuclear side of things, I am all for that in question and answer or afterward. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Eric. Next we have Ms. Amy Chang, currently with Harvard Belfer Center, and most recently with Asia Group and HVAC.
Thanks, David. So thanks to David, Russell, Anna, and everyone else at GTI for putting this panel together today. David's asked me to talk about cyber issues and threats that Taiwan faces, as well as to discuss a little bit about their cyber warfare unit that they want to stand up, and then also cap it off with a discussion of our congressional relationship with Taiwan. So let me first discuss cybersecurity in Taiwan. And let me caveat my remarks here in saying that I'm going to be focusing on Taiwan's defense and security issues, not talking about civil society or the private sector here. So Taiwan has for many years faced a lot of cyber assaults on its government, military, civilian, and private sector networks. So this isn't really news. There are reports from Taiwan's various ministries that cite varying levels of infiltration and cyber operations that are allegedly traced back to China. Taiwanese officials have frequently gone on the record discussing severe cyber attacks on their networks. China's rapid military modernization has propelled Chinese capability development to an unprecedented level and has allowed China to develop the tools and capabilities to be able to affect the military balance both in peacetime and potentially in wartime as well. But more importantly, I think the expansion of capabilities has allowed Chinese actors to dedicate human capital and financial and economic resources to focus on infiltrating Taiwanese networks. Indeed, Taiwan's most recent QDR mentions that it faces threats from Chinese aerospace, technical reconnaissance, cyber, electronic, and psychological warfare units. In response, Taiwan has focused on ways it can defend and deter malicious cyber activity. Taiwan's Defense Minister Feng Shiquan has confirmed the government's intention to establish cyber and electronic warfare units as a fourth branch of Taiwan's armed forces. To the extent that I can divine its priorities from open source literature, I would say that they are first, protecting military and civilian networks from attack and degradation that would compromise Taiwan's security and its advantages in peacetime and wartime. Two, developing asymmetric capabilities. And three, cultivating human capital to fulfill these missions. So I'll focus on the defense portion. While it is always appealing for countries to pursue impressive offensive capabilities, I believe it is more important for a country such as Taiwan to focus on robust, resilient, and scalable defensive capabilities. Without an effective defensive capability, Taiwan will be unable to protect from infiltration and compromises. The DPP's blue paper from May 2015 noted the desire to develop a number of additional network/cyber-centric capabilities, which include real-time network monitoring, threat detection systems, defensive countermeasures against attacks, malware analysis and identification capabilities, and network defense exercises. And while cybersecurity is often viewed as a very sexy topic, half the solutions are really just simple human issues or fixing the vulnerabilities and existing technical flaws. According to Taiwan's CERT, which is the Computer Emergency Response Team documents, the majority of cyber threats facing Taiwan are actually APTs, which are advanced persistent threats that utilize existing vulnerabilities in software and hardware, as well as through phishing or spear phishing emails. It reported that over 90% of its APT attacks occurred through a spear phishing email. So additional solutions on the defensive side could include hardening defenses, patching vulnerabilities across government and civilian systems, improving user awareness and training to secure wireless connections, changing default passwords or changing them frequently, and teaching people not to click on phishing emails. Also investing time into developing processes and protocols for improving the detection of breaches and infiltrations. On the bureaucratic side, I think it's also important for the Taiwanese government to determine how the new cyber warfare unit would integrate or distinguish itself from the existing institutions that address cybersecurity. So we have the Information and Electronic Warfare Command in the Ministry of National Defense and the NSB's National Cybersecurity Department. And I think that, you know, there needs to be more clarity in terms of the roles, responsibilities, authorities, and whether the cyber warfare unit would be responsible for defending only military networks or both military and civilian networks. Moving on to considerations of partnerships. In addition to the continued development of indigenous capabilities, there are also plenty of avenues for the United States, private sector, think tanks, academia, to facilitate more effective defensive capabilities and readiness. First, we can consider tabletop exercises that would allow Taiwan to experience and learn how to respond to conflict or malicious cyber operations. Also help Taiwan to garner and hone best practices on responses, defense, and coordination. Of course, there's also information sharing, which in theory is a good idea, but presents many barriers in terms of legalities of sharing specific information that may be unique to US or Taiwanese intelligence collection, or may encounter issues regarding the sharing of sensitive business information. Also, we could consider continued engagement at cyber-focused international conferences such as DEF CON or RSA, and public-private partnerships on technical education that would allow Taiwan to continue to cultivate and train cyber talent. And moving briefly to the offensive side, I think in considering how Taiwan's cyber warfare unit would cultivate capabilities to provide cyber support in a military operation, given the relative disadvantage Taiwan faces in the size of its forces and its resources, as so aptly described by the previous panelists, cultivating an effective cyber deterrent and honing in on specific offensive cyber capabilities that would buy time in the event of a military conflict, such as targeting China's C4ISR systems, so that the military could respond through other means. These considerations are obviously a natural extension of Taiwan's national defense planning. It's important to underscore here that, you know, that a cyber war is likely not to occur. The development of cyber weapons and tools are really difficult to coordinate to continue to have like and have an attenuated war in the cyber domain. So I think that in this case and in every case, when we're thinking about cyber military operations, they would be paired with kinetic operations, such as air campaigns or amphibious landings. And let me mention here quickly that I think that based on the QDR and a lot of the documents that I've reviewed so far, Taiwan still has a lot of strategic level discussion and development needed in terms of, you know, organization of its different forces, the strategic posture, resourcing, how we're going to pull in the money and resources together and things like that. And then naturally from that, I think the operational and tactical considerations would flow. Let me take this last minute here to briefly talk about how Congress views Taiwan. I think nowhere in the recent past have I seen more support for Taiwan than through the United States Congress. I know that there are a lot of people in this room who will directly work with Congress to ensure that Taiwan maintains a priority topic, and I commend everyone here for their hard work. I'll briefly talk about my former boss, Representative Matt Salmon, who is the chairman of the Asia-Pacific Subcommittee in the 114th Congress, who is a staunch supporter of Taiwan. We pursued and passed legislation to try to help Taiwan increase political space in the international sphere, such as supporting Taiwan's inclusion in international organizations and cooperative organizations such as Interpol. And I think the progress is really continuing here in the 115th Congress. Just last week, Chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Ed Royce, and the new chairman of the Asia Subcommittee, Ted Yoho, introduced a resolution that encourages greater bilateral trade between the United States and Taiwan. I think in order for Taiwan to continue to make progress with this relationship on the Hill, however, it's important for people to continue to educate lawmakers and their staff on what this small island democracy stands for and why it's important to stand up for it. And I'd say that the Taiwan expertise on the Hill is outsized right now compared to that of the Trump administration, not including civil service. So absent clear support from Taiwan from the executive branch, I would say that it's important for senators, members, Hill staffers, and other stakeholders to continue to raise Taiwan's profile. And for those of us outside of government, I think it's also important to continue to have conversations like this. And I'll leave it at here. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for our distinguished panelists. Before I turn to the audience, I'll start off with one question. I seized on Eric's point, and this question is for everybody in the panel. I seized on Eric's comment when he listed the positive toward the negative of what you saw on Taiwan's QDR. And he mentioned that your view of Taiwan, this is a more sensitive issue that has recently come up, with Taiwan's layered deterrence. Mm-hmm. So your view was more negative on Taiwan's ability to strike the PRC. So this is a more sensitive topic because it gets into escalation and everything. So I wanted to just kind of like see the views on the panel about that, because this is more like it made headline news a few weeks ago when the defense minister actually mentioned this in Taiwan's legislative yuan. Usually you have Bill Murray at the Naval War College talking about a porcupine strategy. And the U.S. government, from my experience when I was at the State Department, really wants to prevent regional conflict and security spirals, wants to prevent spirals, wants to prevent this kind of escalation. So with that in mind, what are your views about Taiwan's, you know, this new layered deterrence concept, which I question. The official policy is solid defense, layered deterrence.
My personal view is that defense is layered and deterrence is you have it or not. But anyways, what do you feel about like this recent news about, you know, Taiwan's missiles and this issue about striking mainland PRC facilities? Anybody?
I mean, I think there's a strong argument for Taiwan to have the ability to strike China. I mean, I take your point that they'll never have enough missiles to strike all the targets they need to in a full scale war. But when it comes to escalation, it's also very difficult to imagine a situation in which Taiwan is striking first. So, if you can imagine. You can imagine all sorts of scenarios, but I think if we get to a point where Taiwan was deciding it needed to strike the mainland, it's already been hit. And it's hard to see how that's an escalation, to my mind. And because Taiwan is never going to have the ability to inflict massive punishment on the mainland in the way that China can on Taiwan, I think these are political tools more than tools of war. Certainly, there's going to be an interest in taking out key C2 nodes. Mark Stokes, Ian's colleague, has written quite a bit about this. But the fact, I think Taiwan wants to have an ability to make Chinese people question the way that their government is acting, and an ability to strike the mainland, even if only in a limited way, gives them that.
I actually thought it was interesting that the news thought that this was new. Taiwan has had missile capabilities for this mission since 1962. The current program of record started in the 1980s, and it came to maturity in the 1990s. For reasons of politeness, really more than anything else, the Taiwanese just did not make it public. They didn't put it in their official public documents of this nature, but it's long been known that Taiwan has had land attack, cruise missile programs, and perhaps ballistic missile capabilities as well. And if you look at the vulnerability of the limited number of amphibious staging areas from Zhejiang, especially in Fujian province, and then down to Guangdong, it's clear that at the operational level, there is a legitimate requirement for strikes on these bases in the event that China has begun blockading and bombarding Taiwan, as firing missiles at Taiwan in preparation for amphibious assault on Taiwan. In that scenario, there's no question that Taiwan would need capabilities of this sort and has a legitimate requirement for it. At the strategic, so that's the operational and tactical concern. At the strategic level, I don't know what else Taiwan could do to maintain any sort of semblance of deterrence against China when China has deployed almost 1,500 ballistic missiles across from Taiwan. Of course, Taiwan needs to have the ability then to hold Shanghai at risk if the Chinese are going to hold Taipei at risk, and perhaps even to be able to hold Beijing at risk. Now, of course, this would not be on the same scale as what the Chinese would be doing to Taiwan in this scenario with their missile capabilities. But from the perspective of Zhongnanhai, from the leadership of the CCP, it really doesn't matter, because the political humiliation of Taiwanese missiles raining down for everybody to see on key nodes in China would be really devastating for the reputation of the CCP, and could have devastating impacts on their own ever-fragile legitimacy, especially when tensions are running high, and especially in this type of scenario. So I think there are legitimate strategic, operational, and tactical requirements for these capabilities, and this, of course, is why Taiwan's had them since the 1960s, back when we were a treaty ally of Taiwan. And we never said anything about it because we realized that that was the case. The idea that we would somehow want to limit Taiwan's counterstrike capabilities in this regard, to my mind, only makes sense if Taiwan is going to look like Japan. And we're going to have an alliance, a treaty alliance with Taiwan, and put our nuclear umbrella
in writing over Taiwan, in that case, we could start to think about some sort of a sword and a shield type arrangement. But in the absence of those type of treaty commitments to Taiwan, Taiwan, of course, needs to have its own strategic deterrent of this nature, and that's why it has such a capability and why it should keep developing it.
A strategic deterrent is a nuclear deterrent. Hmm. Is that what you're talking about?
It depends on how you define
strategic.
I define strategic as anything that affects Xi Jinping.
Oh, I see.
Anything that affects the political decision maker in China, in this case Xi Jinping, such a military commission and the full Bureau Standing Committee, is strategic. And that could very much be a conventional capability. It could also be economic. So for example, if Taiwan were to mine the maritime approaches to major ports in China and cripple the Chinese economy in reprisal for the Chinese crippling Taiwan's economy by mining the sea lines off of Geelong and Kaohsiung, for example, I think that could also be considered a strategic deterrent of a type.
Oh, I'll just quickly say, depending on when this information came out, and as Ian pointed that this capability has always existed, I think it's interesting that the promotion of this concept could have political implications in terms of political considerations and effects on how China thinks through, you know, its own calculations on its offensive capabilities and strategic posture. Especially, I think, maybe depending if it came up, you know, with the U.S. domestic political situation the way it is now and the constant changing balance of power between the straits, this could have a lot of strategic value, symbolic value.
One other point on this, for Taiwan, there's domestic political considerations too. Imagine the event of a crisis, Taiwan's government says, well, we can't hit back. That has potentially significant effects on morale at a time when you're trying to maintain public support for potentially ongoing combat operations. I think there's a number of reasons why it's important for Taiwan to be able to hit the mainland.
And I'll ask one more question before I turn it over to the audience. So, Mike, during your presentation, you mentioned that the PRC is practicing for sudden, cruel war. Right? So, that gets to the question of limited war versus total war. Because if you have there's scenarios. People all say, if China has about over 1,000 CSS-6 or CSS-7 missiles, 1,300, 1,600 pointed at Taiwan, unleashes it toward Taiwan, then it's very devastating. We're talking a lot of lives at stake, and we're talking a lot of destruction. So that's the total war scenario, the limited war. Is that why would China ever do that? Why would China go and destroy a vibrant economy, a democracy, millions of people? I feel like the debate with scenario really hinges on total versus limited. So I want to hear the panelists' insights, your insights about this, because a lot of times people are talking about, Taiwan doesn't stand a chance because in a total scenario, but perhaps Taiwan does stand a good chance in a more of a embargo blockade, more of a limited scenario, depending on China's objectives.
There's a whole range of options that China could pursue from the sort of lower end. A blockade is a Series Act 4, but from the blockade up to the total invasion to trying to grab an offshore island in order to make a point. I think part of the reason Taiwan needs the high-low mix is because it needs an ability to respond to all of these contingencies. So, response to an air blockade or a naval blockade is a pretty high-end response, right? You want to put a stop to that. I think Eric made a good point, which is yes, whatever China does, it hopes it will be short and quick and relatively bloodless, at least for itself, so that Taiwan should seek to deny China its objectives, right? So in any scenario, Taiwan needs to be able to to draw it out and make it, I mean, not to be polite, make it as bloody as it can for the Chinese. None of this can be, they can't make themselves, you know, easy pickings. Does that answer your question?
So the reason why I focus mostly on the invasion scenario is that I think if you get to the point where cross-strait relations deteriorate and forces start getting used, it's difficult for me to see how... I think China does have, you know, the sort of holy trinity, or unholy trinity, I guess, for this, of options being, like, decapitation, strikes on the leadership, blockade, invasion. Those are the three most commonly discussed in the literature. And I think if you're going to try and resolve the Taiwan question by force, why would Beijing settle for anything less than all in? Why would they settle for a half measure? So I just don't see. I can understand, like, the military rationale for not just going to all out invasion. That doesn't necessarily mean they would just reach for invasion first. But I think that if things have deteriorated to that point, I think they would want the PLA or the Chinese leadership would want the option with the highest degree of success. And I think in their mind that might look like invasion, like just going all out because things have already deteriorated.
Well, I don't share the view that Taiwan is so hopelessly outgunned that they don't stand a chance in the invasion scenario,
right,
or a blockade scenario, or an air campaign scenario. I think war is the ultimate gamble, and if you look very closely at the layered capabilities that Taiwan has, all the way from the land attack cruise missiles, all the way down to the fortifications along the beaches, and then the fortifications in the urban areas and the plans that have been done in that regard, all the way through, and you think about what that would mean for the PLA and their planners at every stage of their operation, it's clear that the gamble for the PLA in 2020 or even in 2030 would be very, very high, and there's a very real risk that they would lose. There's a very real risk that China would lose, especially once the United States gets involved and we form an ad hoc coalition alongside Japan and Australia and potentially others to come to Taiwan's defense. That picture looks very ugly, or at least it ought to the minds of people in Beijing. And if it doesn't, they've lost their mind. And so to your question, David, it's a great question. Why would China ever do it? I can see the rationale for threatening it. It makes sense for the state media in China to constantly be threatening this. This goes back to Deng Xiaoping. It actually goes back to even to Mao Zedong. There's been a constant threat that China was going to do this. And indeed, China began originally planning for the invasion of Taiwan in the summer of 1949. And that planning ran all the way up to the summer of 1950 when the Korean War broke out. And then, of course, the Third Field Army got diverted to that, away from Taiwan. It makes sense to plan for it. It makes sense for the PLA to prepare for it from their ideological perspective and for their political perspective. But it would never, ever make sense for Beijing to actually seriously consider doing it.
Can I zoom out for a little bit and to think about, because China's decision-making doesn't occur in a vacuum, and we have to look at and wait and see, you know, if we're planning for 2020, 2025, 2030, you know, we have Russia going on right now, we have still wars in the Middle East, we have a potential North Korea problem, well, we have a North Korea problem, but it could get worse, and how all of these things play out are definitely going to affect and hamper China's ability to make a decision about whether or not it wants to pursue something like a forceful takeover of Taiwan.
Yeah, I think, in addition to everything we're talking about, like with the weapon systems and everything, this conversation about scenarios, I think it becomes very, very raw, and it becomes very, because we have, you know, friends in Taiwan, and we have people in the room studied at, you know, Shida or Tsinghua Dashi, Zhenda, or I studied in Beijing at Peking University. So for me to see friends on the U.S., China, and Taiwan side, know, if there's ever a conflict, I see that, like, I see real lives, you know, at stake here, and it becomes very real and very personal, in addition to just, you know, talking about the names and the platforms. So I think through these discussions, our goal is to try to prevent this kind of situation so that we can learn to cooperate and to resolve problems without going to that step. So with that, hopefully the audience will have more lively and optimistic questions of the group than my last slightly downer question. So let's start with Lotta first, please.
Please state your name and affiliation.
My name is Lotta Danielson. I'm with the U.S. Taiwan Business Council. My question is, one of the things that we've heard a lot in the news in the last couple of months have been the idea of including Taiwan in THAAD. And that's something that the Minister of National Defense have been fairly negative on, and I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.
I don't think that Taiwan can BMD its way out of the problem. I think that BMD is very useful, would be very useful to prevent the sort of more limited options, especially those that Chinese options that target Taiwan's political leadership. And PAC-3 can do that pretty well. But if it comes to a larger scenario, you're just going to run out of shots, right? Unless you have thousands upon thousands of interceptors, because you want to have at least two for each incoming, you know, to maximize your chances of defeating incoming. So I just don't see, I can understand the sort of political significance of giving THAAD to Taiwan. It would definitely be a kick on China's shin, but I'm not sure beyond that what sort of strategic advantage it provides, other than you can intercept a few more of the thousands of missiles that they're going to be coming.
Usually the moderator doesn't comment, but since I used to work on the THAAD program at Lockheed Martin, it's definitely a symbolic gesture that Taiwan usually looks for arms sales, saying, hey, we have, you know, what Korea has with the latest thing, a sign of U.S. support. The cost, an entire battalion of 8 missiles per one launcher, times 9 launchers maximum per battalion, turns out to be 72. Missiles per battalion, and the per unit cost of each missile is over $10 million. 72 times 10 is $720 million just for the missiles themselves. Then you have the Raytheon A and TPY-2 radar and everything else, probably $1 billion. So it's a lot of money. You're going to run out of shots. However, to counter, to provide a counter example for Eric's point, is that Raytheon's working on discrimination for the shots. So if you could find out, you know, if the target is something that is more of a potential threat, such as nuclear carrying missile versus non, like smaller bogey, and where you expect it to land. If it's going to, you know, land in the countryside, maybe you don't hit it. If it's going to land in downtown Taipei, then you hit it. So the discrimination would make a difference. So, but let me put the attention back on the panel and back in the audience for questions. Question here, and then I'll turn to the other side of the room, please.
Okay, I'm Jordan Sellers. My question is about maybe some soft power that Taiwan might have through the church. I attend National Community Church, and so we have an A18 outreach, and we pretty much do go overseas. So the question is, what can our church specifically do to use some soft power in Taiwan as far as a defense? And maybe you can explain that to us.
I can't speak on the sort of religious aspect, but I think that the soft power matters a great deal, especially for Taiwan, given that it has the relative diplomatic isolation. I think that the loss of the TPP was a huge blow on the soft power front and economics. But when Taiwan starts going out and looking at other regional partners and what it can do in terms of cooperation with the Japanese, with other sort of regional countries that are right, it won't be like a full-on alliance or it won't be official recognition, but as the U.S.-Taiwan relationship shows, you can do a lot below the official recognition level that helps provide for the defense of Taiwan, and certainly, you know, religious considerations could play into that.
I think religion has the incredible ability to change people's perspectives on Taiwan. I am only speaking about this because my former boss, Matt Salmon, was a Mormon missionary to Taiwan in 1977 to 1979. And, you know, it's been almost 40 years, and he still talks about Taiwan all the time. And so, and he leverages that as a platform to be able to talk about, you know, his connections, not only at a cultural level, but at a deeper religious level too, so.
This is Steele from Georgetown University. I'm wondering what should be Taiwan's priorities before their indigenous submarines and fifth generation jet fighters created, which is about 10 years from now. What should be Taiwan's priorities?
I think, let's see, unmanned systems. Both for surveillance purposes and for strike purposes. On the air defense side, trying to either buy off the shelf or develop relatively short range but very thickly layered air defense systems. So you might not be able to contest the whole strait, but any sort of force that relies on air power, any sort of landing force that relies on close-in air support would have a hell of a time trying to get ashore. Building up smaller surface combatants. I know that there was Taiwanese Navy shipbuilding plan that talked about several different classes of ship that they wanted to pursue, one of which being a sort of Aegis-type destroyer. I think the trade-off there is, do you build a few very heavy ships that might have very good capabilities, but then if you lose one of them, you're out a lot versus fewer but smaller ships like the Tuo Chiang class, which I think has been a very successful model of what Chinese domestic shipbuilding can do. Because then the loss of an individual ship doesn't hit the Navy as hard as the loss of one larger but more advanced ship. So I think that kind of thing needs to come into account in ASW. And the Perrys, are they started arriving? The Perrys they're on their way? Yeah, I think that's a pretty good ASW platform. Has a good track record in combat situations, also pretty survivable. So making the most...
The anti-submarine warfare.
Sorry, yeah. Acronym city. Anti-submarine warfare. So I think that, you know, having the Perry around will be a big boost to the Chinese, or to the Taiwanese ability to defend themselves from submarines.
Thank you. Libo Liu, Voice America. First, I have a question for Amy. The NDAA passed last December, which later became law, I think stipulates that the Pentagon must implement the high-level visit and interaction with the Taiwanese military. Given your experience in the Congress, how likely will the Pentagon do that? And for the gentlemen panelists, I just have two quick questions. One is about the growing cases of espionage, where Taiwanese officials spy for mainland China. I wonder how this has been impeding U.S. and Taiwan cooperation, particularly given, you know, or selling high-tech technology to Taiwan. And then lastly, about submarine, is Taiwan getting help from the United States? You know, like contractors and defense contractors. Maybe you can, David, you can answer that. Are they even allowed to help China at this point? Help Taiwan at this point? Thanks.
Regarding the NDAA and the high-level visits, I think it depends on a number of factors. First, I would say that it depends on who ends up staffing the positions to be able to receive Taiwanese officials. So I think that they need to figure out a lot of the bureaucratic issues, such as, you know, who's going to lead the Asia-Pacific department. And then from there, I mean, I think it really depends on a number of issues as to whether, you know, that's still on the top of their agenda and things like that. But I think that, you know, since it was passed through Congress, I think that members and senators are probably able to, you know, exert pressure to talk about, you know, how this was something that is in law and should be respected and executed.
On the submarine issue, I'm not sure if that's allowed, but I would encourage it to be allowed. I think that in terms of the U.S. providing expertise to Taiwan on defense management issues, I think would be a very sort of low impact but high positive step that could help them with some of these bigger problems. I'm not sure if it's allowed or not. I also don't really know much about the espionage issues, but I suspect that would be a major concern. If espionage for the Chinese is relatively easy, then maybe don't give them the F-35 right away.
Well, I think when it comes to espionage, there's so much that we don't know. And by so much, I mean 99.9% of what goes on in this domain across the Taiwan Strait is completely unknown to us on the outside, and we can't know about it. What we can know is that since the 1990s, the PLA has been executing a very, well-organized campaign, a strategic psychological warfare campaign, to convince Americans that Taiwan is so thoroughly penetrated with spies that we shouldn't sell Taiwan any military equipment. And unfortunately, because this campaign has been a very dogged and persistent one, PLA officer after PLA officer, PLA publication after PLA publication makes these types of claims, eventually Americans will start to internalize what may be very much a false message. If you look at the total number of espionage cases over the past 15 years, in Taiwan it's about 50. In the United States, we've had about 150 spy cases. But again, this is just what's been reported because a lot of these cases are not reported at all. China does not report the number of Taiwanese agents in China that they've arrested, because of course we know that Taiwan also goes to great lengths to collect information on China for its own national security needs, and we have no idea how many successful cases Taiwan has had in China, because what the Chinese will do is when they do catch Taiwanese agents, their PLA officers who are spying for Taiwan, they'll arrest them and they'll say this is for corruption or this is for some other improprietary behavior. And so we really don't know. I think we would be remiss, however, from assuming that this is a problem that is so significant, again, in the absence of knowledge, that it should somehow limit what we do with Taiwan. We wouldn't do that with Japan. We wouldn't do that with South Korea. We wouldn't do that with the NATO ally. And these are all countries that face the same level of threat. And of course, our own country faces a very significant Chinese spy threat as well. But I think it's important to remember that it's a two-way street. And while Taiwan has gotten a bad reputation in this regard, I'm not at all convinced that it's well-deserved, because there's so much more that we don't know.
One more point on that. Legitimate concern, so something we certainly can't ignore, as Ian says, but it's also a useful thing for folks to grab onto that are already not inclined to deepen the U.S.-Taiwan defense relationship. I think if we have an administration here in Washington, and the jury's still out on the Trump administration, but if we were to have an administration which is determined to sell Taiwan more of the arms it says it needs and that wants to deepen the relationship, I don't think the espionage concerns are going to stand in the way. You'll find a way to deal with that if it really is a real challenge.
Good point. In the interest of time, let's start bundling some questions, but start with Chia. And did we have another question back here earlier? Yeah, Chia and John, please.
Chia from United Daily News. I just have a question because the national security officers in Taiwan said yesterday that they're worried about after the Trump and Xi summit, they may postpone the arms sales to Taiwan or change the items on the list. Just want to know if you share that worry. And Do you think the meeting between the two leaders and all these discussions, like the phone call yesterday, discussing the North Korea may actually affect the arms sales to Taiwan in the future? Thank you.
Let's get John as well.
Thank you. Thanks for your comments. I'm John Pollan. I'm a retired naval officer, so that's where my question is coming from. Ian talked about RIMPAC and Red Flag, and he's made those comments before, and I agree with that. Those require, when we data link with the countries, certain technical features, crypto and certain software and protocols, but they're highly structured. The U.S. Navy operates in that area around Taiwan, South China Sea, etc., 24 hours a day. So my question is two-part. One, would there be a value in conducting routine naval operations data linking with the U.S. Navy? And if the answer is yes, if anybody thinks yes, how might we make that happen? Is there a legislative role to encourage that? Or does it go back to an arms sale with all the requisite material, allied tactical publications and procedures and crypto, et cetera? Thank you.
So John, you said routine operations with the U.S. Navy. What kind of operations again?
Any type of operations where they're just conducting data links. And so the point being, a PFG-2 deployed outside of Taiwan is a PFG-2. But a PFG-2 conducting a data link operation with a single Aegis destroyer or cruiser becomes, in a sense, sort of a de facto deterrent. They're not doing anything, but they're just a better force.
So, question about whether or not Trump and Xi's recent meetings and phone calls mean that U.S. arms sales for Taiwan might be postponed, and the value of routine data link operations with the U.S. Navy, if there's a possibility with Taiwan and the U.S.
On the first question, I think there's a lot of reasons for concern about where Taiwan's Asia policy will head, simply because of some of the things he said during the campaign, although I would argue that things said since the election have been much more positive. We're looking at a more, what you might call, conventional approach to Asia. But, you know, as far as what this latest summit means for arms sales, there's just really no way to know. We don't know much about the content of the conversations, but nothing that's been released suggests to me a reason for concern. So it's really just guesswork at this point.
And then, John, to your question, John, I think it may be difficult. There may be some challenge to exchanging crypto for routine data linking with a country that we don't have an alliance with, a mutual defense treaty. So I think one of the reasons it may be easier to do that with Japan or South Korea and their Navy, for example, is because of that unique alliance relationship that we have. With Taiwan, I would anticipate it to be a little more difficult. Of course, we do already have latent interoperability because Taiwan does have Link 16, it does have Link 11, it does have all of these types of communications channels that would allow for data links if and when needed in a crisis or some kind of emergency scenario. I think we probably ought to be thinking about starting lower and working our way. That could mean things like ship visits to Taiwan or allowing Taiwanese ships to visit American facilities. Again, admirals, having serving U.S. naval admirals visit Taiwan and to have exercises out in perhaps the West Philippine Sea, where we have pass exes, for example, and then working our way up over time in that manner.
So this has been a longer panel because there's four speakers. So we're timed to go to 1:30, which is around this time. So if any of you have more questions, please save it and come talk to us after the panel discussion. But on behalf of GTI and our staff here, I want to thank everybody here, thank the panelists, thank the audience for making it today. Have a good day.